get in and out of the courtroom, which apparently has now happened, so you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Thomas Wolfe appearing on behalf of the appellant, Travelers Indemnity Company. This matter comes before the Court on Travelers' petition for further review, which was timely filed after the decision from the Nebraska Court of Appeals. The case has drawn attention from several other entities, and briefs have been filed as friends of the Court. The facts in this case are really not in dispute. Everson Well was covered by a workers' compensation policy issued by Travelers. On February 4, 2014, Bruce Everson and another employee were killed in a motor vehicle accident. This death arose out of and in the scope of employment. Darla Everson, the widow of the owner, Bruce Everson Well, received $250,000 in proceeds from the tortfeasor's insurance carrier, EMC. EMC had $1 million in coverage, and that was allocated between the two decedents 50-50, and then Mr. Everson had two children who were each awarded one-third of the $500,000. Of that amount that was awarded to the widow, the county court determined that Travelers was not entitled to any subrogation, nor was Travelers entitled to a future credit.
Counsel, is it significant to our analysis that the 48-118 disbursement hearing was held in county court rather than district court?
We do raise that issue as jurisdiction. So,
what are your thoughts on that?
This is the only case that I have been involved in, and this is the only case that's reported where the decision was made by the county court and not the district court. 48-118 makes reference to the court in which the proceeding could be brought. There's other references in that statute that it's the district court.
So well, these issues are all coming out of a wrongful death claim, aren't they?
A wrongful death claim is the catalyst.
Well, they're brought, issues they're brought, are all coming they're brought out by the separate, they're brought by the personal representative of the estate for the wrongful death against a third party, aren't they?
Correct.
Okay. Does county court normally have jurisdiction to entertain wrongful death claims?
They would have the jurisdiction to make a dispersal of the proceeds.
Well, they can appoint the PR to bring the action. That's where that has to start.
Yes.
But then the PR, doesn't he file a separate action in the district court against the parties to recover the money, and then the insurance company is interpleaded or a party to the action based upon their subrogation claims against the third party?
Agreed. And this all takes place in the district court and not the county court.
So in this case, there was no district court action filed, is that correct?
That is correct.
So they settled it without filing a lawsuit. That was approved by the probate court, is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay. A settlement, the probate court has exclusive jurisdiction to distribute the proceeds of the decedent, is that correct?
Up to a point, but it doesn't have the jurisdiction to do the subrogation. So the county court had the jurisdiction to make the determination that widow gets $250,000 and the two children split it.
And the first representative then files some request or a motion for the district or the probate court to decide the lien, the workers' comp lien, is that correct?
That was also handled in this case in county court.
Right, and Travelers litigated that issue in county court, is that correct?
Travelers did litigate the issue in county court.
There was a full evidentiary hearing.
Full evidentiary hearing, yes.
And the person represented, did they offer any evidence?
Well, yes, there was evidence offered and introduced in county court.
Not by the personal representative, though, is that correct?
Not by the personal representative.
By the widow?
By the widow, yes.
Is she a party to that action?
I believe so, because she was a beneficiary, certainly.
Heir to law or something.
Heir to law, sure. She had an interest in it, obviously. She did.
Was it only the widow's share that Travelers Insurance had a subrogation claim against?
Yes. We don't make any argument that we're entitled to the share that went to the two children.
Are there two funds involved here, the settlement against the tortfeasor's employee, or tortfeasor's company, and the uninsured motorist claim? Are there two pots that we're looking at?
There is evidence of not only the underlying tortfeasor's policy of $1 million.
And they paid their limits of $500,000 to one decedent and $500,000 to the other decedent, and Travelers claims subrogation to that $500,000 that went to the spouse.
Of the $500,000 that went on the Everston side, that was split. Widow got half, $250,000, and the two children.
And they're seeking subrogation on the widow's amount.
Yes, we're not seeking.
And what about the uninsured motorist payment?
Good question, Your Honor. There was evidence that the $1 million underlying tortfeasor policy had been paid. No question about that.
At the time of the evidentiary hearing?
At the time of the evidentiary hearing, the $1 million had been paid by EMC, the tortfeasor's carrier.
Oh, not the underinsured motorist coverage.
Correct, Your Honor. Right. There was also evidence that there was an underinsured motorist policy in the amount of $1 million. That distribution at the time of the hearing had not been made, but there was evidence in
was
the record.
Was there a payment into the court of that amount, or was there an argument about how much should be paid under that policy? Is that still out there?
No, it is not. Ultimately, the $1 million was paid by the underinsured motorist carrier, and I'm going outside the record, but I've been asked.
Well, does Travelers claim an interest in that?
Travelers does not claim a direct subrogation interest in that, okay, because we're not entitled to subrogate against an underinsured.
Okay,
is it somehow factored in the math, like a set-off?
Yes, I think it should be. I agree with you, Judge. I think it should be factored into the math in this case. I think it should be.
But the county court didn't consider it.
No, the county court
of appeals didn't consider it.
Yes, they did not.
Okay, so nobody considered it until now that you're asking us to consider it.
I think it should be a factor when the court determines a fair and equitable distribution.
Even though there's no evidence at the time of that fair and equitable distribution hearing, is that correct? That was an uncertain amount.
That is correct. There was
a pie in the sky, $1 million may or may not be paid. We don't know who's going to get it. We don't know how much. We don't know any of that.
Some of the factors of consideration that the court has enunciated in its case law does deal with future proceeds. This court has stated that in determining a subrogation action, the court must take into consideration the injured worker's ability to earn money in the future. So, what is that? I mean, that's speculation.
Is it your position that under this statute, the court has authority to either allow a subrogation or not allow a subrogation, depending upon the facts under the statute?
I think it's an abuse of discretion to give a zero. And I think it's also a real abuse of discretion not to give that credit for future proceeds.
What's your position on future distributions of the workers' comp?
I think we're entitled to a complete offset. A complete holiday on paying benefits until the amount given to the widow is.
Was that a dollar-for-dollar consideration?
I think on future credits, yes, it's a dollar-for-dollar consideration.
Haven't we said that we don't have any rigid formulas?
You have to distinguish between the fair and reasonable as to the amount that had been already paid by workers' compensation. So that's the fair and reasonable. The credit or offset is mandatory, it says shall, and I think it should be a dollar for dollar until that credit is used up.
And you think the statute says that?
It says shall be entitled to...
Future credit.
Future credit.
But it doesn't say dollar for dollar, does it?
Shall is mandatory.
Shall doesn't say dollar for dollar, does
shall
it?
Shall, yes, you're right.
Okay.
So when we said, what did we say in Turco, was our comment limited to the settlement, distribution of a settlement?
Yes, yes.
Thank you.
Now, did the Court of Appeals address a future credit?
Yes, they upheld the county court's finding that Travelers was not entitled to any future credit from that proceeds.
What was their thinking in that respect? Did they articulate why they took that position?
Well, they went against the Bacon versus DBA case. They said because it was the employee who brought the action, not the employer, that we were entitled to subrogation. That goes entirely against what this court has said in Bacon.
Counsel, did the county court's order address future credits, or was it silent with respect to future credits? The county court's order.
The county court's order addressed that and said no future credit.
But they just said no subrogation in essence, didn't they?
Well, they said no fair and equitable distribution and no future credit.
The distribution was a zero.
We had already paid workers' compensation proceeds.
$20,000,
$30,000. Okay. But we had over $1 million yet to pay. So the fair and equitable is, do we get any of that $33,000 back? That's one question. Second question is, are we entitled to future credit? I think there's two issues in these cases. Because a lot of times when you have subrogation cases, the workers' compensation benefits have all been paid. But here they weren't because, of course, they're going to be paid until the widow either remarries or dies. If there's no further questions, I'm out of time. Thank you.
As to your argument for a dollar-for-dollar credit, otherwise you don't know how long those benefits are going to be paid. There's no way, there's no bottom number to calculate a percentage, is there?
Correct.
You're going to speculate about life expectancy.
Correct. In wrongful death cases, we have a life expectancy table that we use under the Nebraska Workers' Compensation Act. In the majority of the cases, if it's a whole body injury, your benefits are going to be limited to 300 weeks, you know, total. So there's a cutoff there. Fixed.
But here we're not talking about that. About it could go on for a long, long time or it could be a very short time.
She could get married tomorrow and then she'd be entitled to 2 years benefits.
And if it turns out that it's a very short time and it's based on some sort of percentage, then Travelers is just cut off, right?
We would be cut off, sure, because we're not obligated to pay her workers' compensation benefits anymore, so there's nothing to segregate against.
Sure.
Should she get remarried.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. O'Donnell, good morning to you.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court. My name is Kevin O'Donnell. I'm an attorney from Ogallala. I represent the widow, Darla Evertson, the appellee in this case. And I'm going to talk about some things here in relating to jurisdiction that didn't come up in either the county court or the Court of Appeals. The petition for further review was educational because it forced us to go back and look at legislative history on this. And I think we can explain what the difference is. For one thing, I've been doing this for about 40 years. I've had 3 workers' comp cases in my practice. They've all ended up here in the Supreme Court. But I do a lot of workers' or wrongful death cases. And that's how I got involved in this particular case. When the lien, or the claim for the lien, was filed in the wrongful death case, I'd never had that happen before. So I was kind of unsure about it, but we went along. We had our full trial. We had our appeal. And then all of a sudden, we hear about, well, they didn't have jurisdiction. The county court did not have jurisdiction with regard to workers' compensation. New argument, didn't know. Thought maybe the county court didn't have exclusive jurisdiction with regard to wrongful death cases. So went back and looked at the legislative history. Just so happens that in 1937, the legislature amended or repealed the statute that was there from 1929 and added language. And it said, I'm going to kind of edit this, that such amount for wrongful death shall not be subject to any claim against the estate of said decedent. Okay. This court cited a case a year ago, a state of panic, in which the court separated out two distinct areas of law, wrongful death and estate survival claims, a whole different set of factors associated with elements of proof, damages, etc. And it occurred to me that maybe we went along with this to begin with, that in fact this subrogation claim, because it resulted from the employer-employee situation, was in fact a claim against Mr. Evertson's estate, as opposed to a claim against the widow under the wrongful death statute. There's a case that was cited in 1931 with regard to 1929 statute and for wrongful death. That statute's kind of amorphous. I mean, it doesn't have any of this language in there. And there was a case that was cited on that, Bronder, and at least from my reading of it, it didn't separate out those two different causes of action. Everything was just piled in on it. And of course, after 1937, Bronder's no longer good law. So from 37 until today, we've had some form of this statute with that language. And this is the first case in 75 years that has been before this court involving subrogation and wrongful death. Okay? All these cases have been cited, Turco, number of, are all personal injury cases involving the employee and the employer. Now, one of them involves wrongful death on this, which begs the question, is in fact the lien against the employee's interest or his estate's interest, and has nothing to do with the wrongful death statute.
If this hadn't been a settlement and litigation had been necessary, it would have been filed in district court, the wrongful death action, correct?
Yes, that's absolutely correct.
The only reason we're in county court here is because there was a settlement, and everybody was trying to get approval of that settlement.
Everybody was trying to get approval of that settlement, and Travelers was involved in that action. They could have brought it up to district court. They could have objected to, at that time, I mean, I'm assuming, you know, they're a big company, they have very good lawyers, they would have known about this jurisdictional problem, if in fact it was a jurisdictional problem.
The parties can't consent by consent create subject matter jurisdiction. You
no,
agree
I
with
know that?
That.
I fully understand that, and I agree with that. I'm simply saying that we went through a trial, we went through an appeal, it never came up, and now we're dealing with it right now.
And we agree that subject matter jurisdiction can be raised at any time,
yes.
Is that correct?
Yes, it can. But I'm just talking about the equities involved in this situation. It wasn't raised, we went to a trial, there's really not much dispute as to the facts. If you looked at the record, you'd see that you know, everything got in, all the evidence was in there, it wasn't, you know, there's nothing there.
And jurisdiction is also not conferred by equitable estoppel either,
No, I don't think it is.
So,
I think that's correct.
So but either there is or there isn't jurisdiction over this in the county court.
Well, let's put it a different way. Maybe this claim doesn't have anything to do with the wrongful death action, and that in fact it is not a subrogation lien against wrongful death proceeds, but rather estate proceeds. So I'll give you a good example of what I'm talking about.
This has been a misnomer.
It's been quite a case, I'll tell you that.
So you're saying, in your view, or you're positing, this isn't there's not a wrongful death action going on here. It's a question of infusing an estate with some money in a way, it doesn't matter.
Well, let me, if I might, if I understand the question here. A year ago, you cited the panic case, okay? In that, you allocated out, like, causes of action and elements of damage. On the estate side, you had funeral expenses. Well, guess what? They're asking for funeral expenses. It's not a wrongful death claim.
I mean, the law right now is that a workers' compensation carrier who has paid benefits to an injured employee has a right of subrogation against the third party for the benefits paid to the injured employee.
Yes.
That's the extent of the law right now.
Well, or in his estate, for example, any of if survival or survivor action was brought, his dependents from the estate would be entitled to whatever losses as enunciated.
Are you suggesting a carrier is another potential creditor in the estate?
Well, I'm not sure I understand the question. But
when they file the claim,
aren't
they infusing themselves into the probate as a creditor?
We assume that that's exactly what happened on it. I mean, you know, like I said, I've done three cases.
And if they do that, then there's a statute that says they don't recover.
Yeah.
Counsel, I understand you to be saying that the funeral expenses fall on the survival statute side of the ledger, correct?
Right. It's in.
What about the 700 some odd per week? That's basically wage replacement, correct?
I'm sorry.
The benefits that are being paid weekly to the widow by travelers.
Which
side of the ledger does that fall on?
Wrongful death.
Okay.
Because that's been identified as an aspect of damages.
Well,
that's wrongful death's.
If you look at the complaint that we filed, because I was hired, I have nothing to do with the estate, nothing like that. We narrowed the application. Her sole and only purpose was wrongful death. Had nothing to do with any of his other estate assets or estate proceedings or anything else. We were hired specifically to do that. It's very narrow, and so...
But you allege pain and suffering in there, is that correct?
No, we didn't.
In the application?
No.
For the appointment of the personal representative?
No, did not.
Okay.
And I'm cutting out the parts that would apply only to injury.
Right.
It says, when a third person is liable to the dependents of the employee for the death of the employer shall be subrogated to the right of the dependents against such third person.
And I think that has everything to do, I mean, you're talking about the employee-employer relationship, and it's everything to do with a survivor or survival estate matter, not wrongful death.
But the survival claim is for the injuries, pain, and suffering that were experienced by the employee before death. The death claim is strictly the wrongful death.
It is. That's correct.
And so I don't understand that argument in terms of 48.118. I think where you and I may be on the same wavelength is we have to reconcile this language of 48.118 with the statutory language that you quote from the wrongful death claim, that it shall not be a claim against the estate. But I'm not sure that we can't do that fairly easily.
Well, if you look, if I might, this was brought the under 48.118.04. It makes no specific reference to, it just says the court in which the matter is there, that it shall make a fair and equitable distribution if there's not an agreement. I'm pretty sure that's what it says.
You don't think the tension between these two statutes can be resolved?
Well, I'm just saying that the statute under which the claim was made, which is 04, doesn't say district court, doesn't say workman's compensation, it just says the court in which the matter is in dispute, that should be decided by that court.
Counsel, before you sit down, I read the county court's order as rationalizing the decision not to distribute anything to the insurer as based on two things. One, that the insurer was in the business of risk and assessing risk, and two, that the insurer received a premium for doing so.
Well, that's part of it.
Was there some other rationale for not distributing any of this to the insurer?
The loss encountered by, it goes on at great length about the suffering that she was involved in on this thing. And I think he tried to conform with the statute, with the decisions that have been made by this court. But like I say, all those decisions have to do with personal injury. None of them have to do with wrongful death.
My question to you is whether, as it regards the comp insurer, whether those are relevant considerations. The fact that the insurer is in the business of risk is true with respect to every insurer, and the fact that the insurer receives premiums for accepting that risk is true with every insurer. And if so, does that exclude all insurers from ever getting a disbursement?
No, I don't think so.
Why not?
I think here what they're asking for is to be bonded, basically. In other words, there's no risk. We are entitled to every single dollar. You heard that here. They heard it in the county court. They heard it in the Court of Appeals. It wasn't a case of balancing. We're entitled to everything.
Well, even if they aren't entitled to everything, aren't they entitled to something? Isn't zero, in effect, an application of the make-whole doctrine?
No. No. I don't think so. I think it's just a case of balancing the equities, which we trust our trial courts to do, and this is what this trial court did.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Is there any time for rebuttal? There is no time for rebuttal. On we go then to the next case of the day, which is Sanders versus Frakes. Justices Castle and Stacy are recused in this particular matter. Justice Kelch will rejoin the court, and the court will also be